to the third case, IP of A, West 86th Street, et al. Versus Morgan Stanley Mortgage Capital Holdings, et al. Mr. House.
Yes. May it please the court, my name is Brian House. I am counsel for the appellants in this matter, IP of A, West 86th Street, 1 through 20. Those are a series of limited liability companies that were formed to possess a fractional interest in investment commercial real estate. Now, as a part of a commercial real estate financing, Morgan Stanley required that specific escrow accounts be established for taxes, insurance, replacement of certain building components, and tenant improvements and leasing expenses. Although there's no doubt that when that transaction was entered into, the loan would either be sold or securitized. And in fact, the investors, through IP of A manager, ultimately consented to the future sale or securitization of the loan. It was stipulated initially in both the commitment letter for the loan and then later in a document that became known as the Reserve and Security Agreement, that the escrow funds would follow the loan when it was sold or transferred, and that they were to follow the loan by assignment. Now, that didn't happen. What happened here instead is that the loan was ultimately discounted and sold to one of the persons involved in the setup of this real estate investment scenario. And Morgan Stanley kept the money to discount the loan even further than the negotiated percentage discount. So really what happened here is that the escrow funds, as created by the Reserve and Security Agreement, were transformed, if you will, from real money into a hollow promise on the part of someone else to take action, and that someone else was not Morgan Stanley.
Let me ask you about that, Mr. House. As I understand it, the funds were not required to be segregated, no prohibition on commingling. So at least as I look at this, the escrow accounts look like simply an IOU from the lender to the borrowers.
Well, certainly the document said that the funds could be commingled. However, with all due respect, I won't accept all of your characterization because the funds were very specifically set forth. Both the commitment letter and then later the Reserve and Security Agreement specifically stated what these monies were going to be used for and how the deposits into those accounts would be calculated. And in fact, when the so-called omnibus assignment agreement was executed, these funds were segregated and calculated down to the penny, and it was well over $1 million.
Right, but ultimately it remains a promise to pay. Right.
It remains a promise to pay.
And the principal difference is that instead of Morgan Stanley making that promise to pay, it becomes the crook, Mr. Oaken, making the promise to pay.
And that is a very, very significant distinction for two reasons. First of all, we argue in our brief that under the law of Indiana, this really wasn't an assignment at all, and that is in part on what is termed the Navin Doctrine, which comes from a case called Navin versus Colonial Hotels, and I'll come back to that in just a second. And secondly, when you describe with the specificity that was utilized here the nature of these funds, we believe that they should properly be viewed as so-called specific are deposits for a specific purpose. Indiana courts have utilized or looked at banking law in evaluating non-banking transactions. And in fact, I sort of like the phrase I believe used by Judge Hamilton in the first argument this morning, that Morgan Stanley, regardless of what it wants to say, it's kind of a quasi-bank when it's making mortgage loans. In Indiana law, the deposits can be general, special, or for a specific purpose. General deposits, that's your average savings account, checking account. Special deposit, you get the very thing back. I put my father's wristwatch in a safe deposit box, and that's what I'm entitled to. Now, funds for a specific purpose are those deposits. They can be commingled. They can be handled by the bank generally as the bank sees fit, but they're to be used for very specific reasons. And I don't think there could be any clearer example of that than what is stated here, given the detail of the commitment letter and the detail of the reserve and service account. In fact, where this really manifests itself, and this was covered in the reply brief primarily in the district court, is when this all tanked, the investors went looking for the reserve funds because they thought maybe they could salvage this through some spiff up and improvements and additional leasing activities. And that brings me to my second point, and this is what we call the Navin Doctrine. Indiana law is pretty clear that an assignment is a look-see, if you will, of not only the thing assigned but the liabilities behind it. And again, the reserve and security account, which in essence is tied to the consent that were signed here, the LLC consent, specifically state that any and all documents related to this transaction must be, and I quote, upon terms and conditions identical in all respects to the terms and conditions set forth in the commitment letter. And again, as I've said, that carried over into the reserve and service agreement. Well, that's important. Because initially the people were dealing, the investors, the IPF investors were dealing with the Oaken entity, but also Morgan Stanley. That was the lender. And what Indiana recognizes in Navin is a great principle of law, and that is a contracting party has the right to the benefit you anticipate from the character, credit, and substance of the party with whom you contract.
So let's say that at the time Morgan Stanley sold the loan to the IPA lender, Morgan Stanley wired the $1.3 million over the IPA lender, and then the IPA lender sent money back to Morgan Stanley to pay for the loan. In your view, would there still be a breach?
Well, I think there would be, because even though there weren't wires back and forth, that's really what happened here. The omnibus assignment and the borrower's escrow instructions, in effect, cancel one another out. I would think that at least the helpful distinction in your honor's example is this. Obviously, the escrow accounts were never reestablished. And there is, I believe, a qualitative difference between an act of omission and an act of commission. It's been noted in the briefs of the appellants that the in-house counsel for IP of A lender knew that the escrow accounts had to be reestablished. We submit to this court that had the escrow funds followed the loan as the documents required, that they would have been there. Certainly something could have happened.
So it's your argument that Morgan Stanley had the obligation to ensure that the IPA lender established this $1.3 million bucket after obtaining the loan?
Absolutely.
Okay, so where in any of the contracts is that obligation imposed upon Morgan Stanley?
It is found in the RSA, the reserve and security account, specifically section 3.4, and that the borrower understands and agrees that in connection with the sale of the loan pursuant to section 18.1 of the security instrument, and I now quote, all of lender's interest in the reserve and reserve escrow accounts will be assigned to the transferee of the loan. And frankly, the major point here is that while Morgan Stanley basically says, well, this was an assignment and that the documents gave Morgan Stanley broad authority to deal with the escrow accounts as they saw fit, it's not an assignment in any recognizable form or fashion, in that assignments generally transfer property or specific rights. Here,
so you're saying that 3.4 creates the obligation that we've been discussing, correct?
Yes. because it does require an assignment of the escrow accounts.
Right.
The transferee of the loan.
Of all lenders' interest in the reserves and the reserve escrow accounts will be assigned to the transferee of the loan, which is IPA lender, right?
Yes.
Where does it say that Morgan Stanley has to ensure that once IPA lender gets that money, it has to actually continue to retain that money in an account?
Well,
as opposed to using it for whatever other purposes it wants to use it for.
Because what establishes that obligation is that the structure of the initial transaction carries forward. I mean,
but I thought your position is not necessarily that Morgan Stanley was required to look over Oaken's shoulder and make sure that this $1.3 million was set aside, but rather that the transfer documents simply did not excuse Morgan Stanley from its any continuing obligations. Ordinarily, when there's an assignment, maybe this is your Navin point, but when there's an assignment, obligations, the original obligor remains obligated unless the obligee has consented to a release.
That's exactly the holding of Navin. And that is in part our point. We recognize here that the documents did mitigate in some small respects the obligations of Morgan Stanley, commingle, no trust, et cetera, and consent to the sale. But this was a very material change in the transaction, because when Morgan Stanley not only accepted but insisted upon the borrower's escrow instructions, which we would submit as indication that Morgan Stanley had a little angst about the way they were putting this together, they simply allowed the distinct and specific escrow funds to sort of evaporate under the language of the omnibus assignment and the borrower's escrow instructions. And that's the point about Navin. I mean, you know, Morgan Stanley is a lot bigger, better, and well-known than Ed Oaken and his IP of A entities, and that's why these investors should have been able to rely with confidence upon the fact that Morgan Stanley would transfer actual escrow funds to the transferee of the loan.
You want to reserve some time?
Yes, please, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. House. Ms. Bowen.
May it please the Court, Connie Boland of Nixon Peabody for Defendant Appellee Morgan Stanley Mortgage Capital Holding. On this appeal, in a breach of contract and conversion case, the standard of review is de novo. The panel is being asked to review an order on cross motions for summary judgment, so there is really no genuine issue of material fact here. Judge Barker of the court below got it exactly right in her well-reasoned opinion and order when she dismissed the claims of plaintiff appellant's investors. The only issue before the court is when Morgan Stanley netted the amount of the reserves against the purchase price in the loan sale, did Morgan Stanley comply with the loan agreements? Judge Barker found that it did. And there can be no doubt but based on the unambiguous terms in these loan agreements that Judge Barker was right. There is no term in the loan agreements that requires Morgan Stanley to structure the sale transaction when it sold the loan in any specific manner. The only
under the terms of the documents, when Morgan Stanley sold the loan, was it also released from any obligations it might have had?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Where do we find that in the documents?
When it sold the loan, it conveyed all of its interest and all of its obligations, and you would find it in the omnibus assignment, which is in the record, Your Honor, at 8420, and the assignment of mortgage and assignment of lease and rents at 8419, and then the Allonge endorsement to the note. What the
That includes the usual in contracts, when you assign your rights, you don't necessarily get excused from your obligations.
Correct, Your Honor. This was more than an assignment. It really was a sale. And the entire loan went from one lender to the other. And all of the rights and obligations and benefits went from one lender to the other.
So at 84, 19, and 20, we'll see language that the borrowers agreed to, releasing Morgan Stanley from its obligations for its handling of the escrow.
No. What you will see, and I'll answer that question, what you will see, Your Honor, is a sale, a complete transfer of all of the loan documents to IP of A buyer, the buyer who we've defined, where you will find the investors signing off on that is in the consent of co-owners and the amended limited liability agreements. The consent is docket 84, the amended LLC agreements at 84-2, and the consent had the commitment letter attached to it. And each one of the investors signed it, and that's at 84-12. Let me just lay a little background, Your Honor. This was a TIC investment. Each one of the 20 LLCs owned the real property as a tenant in common. And in a TIC investment, a typical TIC investment, and particularly in this TIC investment, the TIC investors, they're strangers to each other before the investment. They were referred by, to this investment by a broker, and they lived in various places across the country. So bringing these 20 divergent entities together to sign documents is usually an arduous task. So Morgan Stanley's practice was that before it lent any money, it had these TIC investors sign documents that delegated broad authority for Morgan Stanley to, it's broad authority to an agent so that this agent could sign the loan documents and any documents related to the loan documents, including the loan sale.
But wasn't that limited to terms and conditions identical in all material respects to those set forth in the commitment letter?
Exactly, Your Honor.
So could Okun have agreed on behalf of the borrowers, for example, to a higher interest rate?
No. That would have changed the terms.
Okay.
The commitment letter did not provide for that. What the commitment letter said, and it says it on page 13 of 16, it says that the investors agree that the loan may be sold. And remember, Morgan Stanley was planning on securitizing this loan, so the language was sufficiently broad to require the investors to sign additional documents. For example, if the loan had been securitized and one of the rating agencies required some additional documents to be signed, then the investors committed when they signed the consent with the commitment letter attached that they would be available to sign those additional documents. And because the sale of the loan transaction was not agreed to or defined in February 2005 when the original loan was given, Morgan Stanley had to demand broad authority from these investors so that when Morgan Stanley did sell this loan, it had the right to craft the transaction as it saw fit. And that was how broad the authority was given. There were no other terms in the loan agreements that require Morgan Stanley to monitor the escrow funds. Remember, Your Honors, we're dealing here with sophisticated investors. The underlying transaction was done by a private placement memorandum, and the private placement memorandum had all of these 20 limited liability companies, the investors, sign off as accredited investors. And it went on for 12 pages about the risks here. Indeed, it did have certain safety nets, so to speak. There was a $1 million guarantee that Mr. Okun provided, and there was a master lessee, and the master lessee was obligated to pay the rent even if underlying renters in the warehouse in Indianapolis that was at issue here vacated the premises and stopped paying rent. So there was a fail-safe, so to speak, Your Honor, so that there would be funds going into the account to pay the loan. But
Any of those folks have the same kind of creditworthiness that Morgan Stanley did?
No, but, Your Honor, Morgan Stanley was not even involved in this transaction at the beginning. I'm glad you asked me that. The original loan here was made by the Dice Group. So when these 20 plaintiffs came in and invested, it wasn't even clear that Morgan Stanley was going to make a loan here. The Morgan Stanley came in about 6 weeks later and refinanced. But that deal was not done. So there's no basis, in fact, in this record, Your Honors, for these investors to come forward and say that they relied on Morgan Stanley. Nothing's there. One important thing that I would like the court to understand is that the only thing at issue really is the structure of the loan sale. That's all the investors are complaining about. And to be clear, Morgan Stanley received no windfall here. By structuring the sale, by netting out the reserves against the purchase price, Morgan Stanley did not get any more money. The buyer of the loan received full credit for the escrows.
You all insisted that the escrow instructions be executed, correct?
They're part of the loan sale documents, yes, Your Honor.
And since it's on a motion for summary judgment by Morgan Stanley, is it reasonable, giving the benefit of the doubt to the investors on that issue, that we can assume that was something you all insisted on?
That Morgan Stanley insisted
on getting the escrow instructions.
Your Honor, it's part of the loan sale document, okay. So I can't disagree with Your Honor.
Okay. And didn't this strike anybody at Morgan Stanley as a little fishy? We're not talking about a sale of this loan to an independent third party. We're talking about a sale to the agent of the borrowers, who's clearly got a conflict of interest here.
Well, Your Honor, actually, if you read Mr. Ellis's affidavit, Mr. Ellis, and he's at docket 82-6, it was the normal custom of Morgan Stanley. If a loan couldn't get securitized, they did what is called a whole loan sale. And the first person they usually went to see if they wanted to buy the loan was the sponsor of the underlying investment. Well, why was that? Because that sponsor was very familiar with the property and had already done the due diligence and knew the investors. And that person or entity would know well enough whether or not it wanted to put further money into the investment. And at the time, Your Honor, I mean, plaintiffs came and chose to invest with Mr. Okun before Morgan Stanley was involved. And Morgan Stanley thought that this was a benefit, going to plaintiff's agent and having that agent purchase the loan. We didn't perceive any issue in that regard, Your Honor. And so there was nothing fishy at all about it. That was in the ordinary course.
Even with the treatment of the escrow account, is that ordinary?
Actually, the netting is a common bank practice, Your Honor. And since our obligations were only to assign our rights in the escrow account, and the escrows were not a trust account, and they could be commingled, that's in Section 3.1 of the Reserve and Security Agreement, these escrow funds were not a separate rest that you could identify. That's the reason why the conversion claim fails. You can't identify these monies. They were commingled. And that's the reason why Morgan Stanley didn't have an obligation to identify the account and transfer it over. The fund was just cash, and it was they didn't have an obligation to keep it separate. That's the reason why the deposits for the specific purpose argument fails as well.
The plaintiffs raised this Navin case in their reply brief, and you have not yet had an opportunity to address Navin. Would you like that chance right now?
I would love that. Thank you, Your Honor. The Navin rule is simply that rights coupled with liabilities under a contract cannot be assigned in such a way that the assignor no longer remains liable, unless you get the consent of the adverse party. Here, we had the consent of the adverse party. In the consent and the amended LLC agreements, the investors agreed that the loan could be assigned and sold at any point in time without notice to them. So the Navin rule doesn't apply. And on pages 4 to 5 of the reply brief, the investors imply as much. But then on page 8 and 10, they continue to keep citing to the Navin rule. The Navin rule has no application to this case.
Because of the consent.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Given by an agent of Oaken. So an agent of Oaken consented on behalf of the borrowers to allow the transfer of the loan to an Oaken entity.
No, Your Honor, that's not the consent I was referring to. What I'm referring to is the February 6, 2005, consent actually signed by the 20 investors here in the consent of co-owners before the original loan was made, and in the amended LLC agreements when they signed the authority over to Mr. Oaken to have his company sign the loan documents and have his company sign all the documents relating to the loan, which includes the loan sale agreements. And that broad delegation of authority, construed under Indiana contract law, with all of the contracts being construed together on ambiguous terms, was sufficient authority for Morgan Stanley to close the loan sale as it did. There's not one term in any of the loan agreements that Morgan Stanley breached. When plaintiff's counsel addresses the issue, he refers to 3.4 of the reserve and security agreement. But he just read that to this court, and all it says is that Morgan Stanley will assign its interests in the escrows to the buyer. Morgan Stanley did that in the omnibus assignment and the three other documents accompanying the omnibus assignment. I'd like to address a few of the issues raised by my adversary, and I'd like to address the breach of contract conversion and the new argument for fiduciary duty. Let me start with the contract. Clearly, with this broad authority, in the consent and the commitment letter and the amended LLC agreements, there can be no question but that these investors delegated sufficient authority to Oaken's entity to sign the loan documents and all documents relating to the loan. And there's a settled Supreme Court precedent that we cite that the word related should be interpreted broadly. Now, my adversary says that Morgan Stanley did not assign the reserves. And we did in the documents that I've been referring during my presentation, the omnibus assignment, the allonge, the assignment of mortgages, and the escrow instructions. These documents contain language such as Morgan Stanley sells, transfers, assigns, delivers the loan documents, including the reserve and security agreement, including the reserves themselves, to the buyer.
But where's the language transferring Morgan Stanley's obligations? Usually we think of the creditor as just having rights, but there's this little corner of this transaction that's in dispute here where it has obligations.
The omnibus assignment said that all of the contracts attached to, on the list attached here to, are hereby sold, transferred, delivered, assigned, and set over to the buyer. And on the list attached to the omnibus assignment is the reserve and security agreement. So the entire agreement goes over to the buyer, which was the Oaken entity. And indeed, we know that from the intent of the parties, Your Honor, because in the record, when Mr. Oaken was describing the loan sale to the investors, he said, this is the same loan. Now it's with one of our affiliates. We bought the loan from Morgan Stanley. And twice in communications with the investors, Mr. Oaken acknowledged that his entity had the obligation to fund the escrow accounts. And Mr. Hochter, in his affidavit, acknowledged he's the counsel for the Oaken entity, the buyer. He acknowledged that he advised Oaken to replace or cover the reserves. And that's at docket 83, page 405. By netting the reserves against the purchase price, I'm sorry, I just noticed the red light went on, Your Honors.
That's all, Ms. Fulton.
Thank you.
I said, now you can conclude that.
Oh, okay. Okay. There was no modification of the loan, as the investors contend. The buyer received the full benefit of the escrows. I would just suggest that the fiduciary duty argument should not was waived and should not be considered by this court. And for the following reasons, we respectfully request that this court affirm the order below and dismiss both claims as against Morgan Stanley. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Boland. Mr. House?
Thank you, Your Honors. Let me briefly state that, first of all, one of the key points of dissension here is whether, in fact, the investors consented to this assignment without any carry-on of liabilities from the adverse party. Well, they didn't. They didn't. You can search the record with a microscope, and you will never find any language whatsoever that says that in the process of transferring or selling or securitizing the loan, that the escrow accounts can be netted out and kept by, in this case, Morgan Stanley. It's simply not there. What you do find, however, is that both in the commitment letter and in the reserve and security agreement, that if the things go on in the future, that under the LLC consent, documents can be signed, contemplated, or related to the loan, but only if they are upon terms and conditions identical in all respects to the terms and conditions set forth in the commitment letter. And indeed, it is significant to note that the investors signed off on that. That's important because they would have seen it. Whether they came from 15 different states or whatever, these are presumably intelligent people who would read these documents.
So what was the change?
The change was that the escrow money didn't go with the loan. And that's important because the escrow, again, as we have argued, was set up to do very specific things that would keep this building functioning, solvent, what have you. There was money for taxes. There was money for insurance. There was money for maintenance and tenant leasing.
But the obligation survived. So the new lender had the obligation to maintain an escrow.
Well, I would argue, Your Honor, that there's a significant difference between an obligation and cash. And, you know, I may have an obligation to pay my my credit card, but I might not have the money. In this case, had the assignment been a true assignment where the funds followed the loan, that cash would have been there.
So Morgan Stanley would have sent the cash to the IPA lender. And then Morgan Stanley would have had a continuing obligation to monitor new IPA lender to make sure that that $1.3 million stayed intact somewhere.
Now, we don't go that far, Your Honor, and I would certainly state that I don't believe that's the subtle distinction, which, you know, counsel for Morgan Stanley tried to say, well, we sort of say Navin applies and then it doesn't. No, we tried to make the distinction that the general rule of Navin should apply, that there has to be some sort of consent to the exchange of liabilities and the contractual obligations. And therefore, we think that the Navin rule is very instructive to this court given the nature of these deposits. We don't hold, and this is the difference, that Navin would require that Morgan Stanley had to call Oaken up every month or so and say, hey, how are the escrow accounts looking? Or where are they? But at a minimum, the money had to go with the loan. And we do think that's extremely significant by virtue of what we said.
Yeah, Mr. Ask, can I refer you just for a second to Section 3.1 of the Reserve Security Agreement?
Yes.
Doesn't that state rather unambiguously that Morgan Stanley and not the IPA lender was not required to treat the funds as a trust or to avoid commingling funds?
It states that they may commingle the funds.
It says they, yeah. Right.
They may commingle the funds, and as we've argued, that's simply for an administrative convenience. And it also states that a trust is not created simply by this document. But we've also argued that that doesn't mean that they're without obligation, and that's why we bring forward the notion recognized in Indiana law of deposits for a specific purpose. I mean, if I touch on it one final second, I believe that the no trust language is here to give Morgan Stanley investment flexibility of those funds. If this truly was a trust, then the array of investments that would be available to a so-called trustee would be limited, i.e. to investment-grade investments. Probably wasn't. Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.